Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 7:55 a.m. and that is on Saturday, June 2nd. And this is the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Well, I do apologize for recording a day late, but I was spent most of the day yesterday in a what I these days tend to regard as flying coffins. I was just not compos mentis by the time I got home yesterday, so I thought the long-term video and audio would benefit from just a few hours sleep. Well, the thing that I found interesting last week was the Contrary Opinion Club's dinner in London, and I thought that I would concentrate on some of the ideas that were espoused at the meeting. There were, I think it was 16 of us, and almost everybody was a fund manager in one way, shape or form, and other than myself, everyone else has had a very lengthy career, so there was an awful lot of experience in the room. So then if we go back, and if I try to remember everything, because it's Chatham House rules, so I'm precluded from sharing names, but certainly I can share ideas. So, well, I can tell you what I said, and then we can go ahead and think about what everyone else was thinking about. Well, I was quite keen to highlight that the Russell 2000 has just broken out. That is the resumption of its medium-term uptrend, and it improved upon that performance on Friday. So that's certainly something that's rather bullish. Then if we look at the NASDAQ, we have a rather similar condition. The NASDAQ has broken up and out. It was closing out the day on Friday above the 7,000 level. So that's a new closing high. And that's also rather interesting. So there is the potential here that the NASDAQ is about to resolve on the upside. Well, one of the things that I've been saying since January is that we were in a medium-term correction, that a medium-term correction can last for anything from 6 to 18 months, but over the last month I've been skewing towards that the likelihood was that this correction would probably be on the shorter side. So that is the possibility that I think we have in front of us right now, that we are coming towards the end of this consolidation. And I think that that is still a contrarian idea. I also believe that we're in the throes of a secular bull market. And it is being driven primarily by technology. That there is... and one of the reasons I started writing this book, I'm approximately 17,000 words in, and I think it'll probably have a word count of probably around 60,000, is because I think that we're moving into a much more different phase. One of the questions that people have been asking me for years, and particularly the last two or three years, doesn't matter where I go, but they've asked me, what am I going to do when the robot takes my job? Well, I found that a rather difficult question, because there are obviously going to be some jobs that disappear, that there will be a certain amount of automation that is going to ensure that some people are no longer going to be required. So I think that is certainly there is nothing that we can do to get around that particular point. But on the other hand, if we try and look for some evidence before we draw some conclusions, well, where are the countries that have focused most on automation? And there are places like South Korea and Japan and Germany and increasingly China. And those are the centers of the global manufacturing. Well, they are some of the biggest global manufacturing hubs. So therefore, it is in the countries that have not adopted automation with vigor, those are the places where we have the the greatest questions being asked about the loss of manufacturing jobs. So, therefore, it is not the rise of automation that is the true enemy of manufacturing, but rather something else. So, if it's something else, what is it? Well, it's globalization. If we look at where for what the impact of globalization has been on, not so much on the very low classes, and not so much, and it has been a particular benefit for the people that have money, but for the people that were in the good-paying manufacturing jobs, the argument was to move those jobs overseas and eliminate the labor force cost. So that's largely what has happened, but nothing has really come in to replace them, particularly in the industrial heartlands of North America and the UK and places like Australia. So that's and of course in Australia or indeed in Canada you have the resources sector, and that has helped to soak up a significant amount of the available labor. But you don't have that to the same extent in places like the UK or much of Europe, or indeed in the USA to nearly the same extent. Although obviously the US has got its energy sector, energy is not as labor intensive as mining is, or indeed the cutting down trees. So that is where we have got this rising question about populism, and it isn't simply populism. It's that we have an evolving condition where there is a significant demographic are ticked off with the status quo. They feel like that they have been sold short by the adoption of the globalization business model, that the evolution of a global logistics chain, which really didn't exist about 35 years ago and is now taken for granted, has left an awful lot of people disenfranchised. So, if we're going to think about risks, well, we have to think that that is where some of the risks are, that the rise of populism, where in the Philippines you have thousands of people being executed over the last 18 months with absolute impunity on the basis that they're drug dealers with no habeas corpus, is considered, well, that's okay then, isn't it? And then we look at what's going on in India. Well, we've been admirers of Modi, and he has certainly helped the Indian stock market, but that does not gloss over the real point that he is a populist leader, and there has been a rise in Hindu nationalism under his administration. In fact, Modi was the first of the populist leaders, and I don't think we have enough time to list all of the populist leaders that have popped up in Europe. But certainly what's going on in Italy is holds the potential that we're going to see some upset there, particularly since we now have a populist government in Italy, that Rajoy in Spain has just been ousted, and not without good reason because of the corruption that his administration represented. But you have Action for Deutschland now having seats in the Bundestag in Germany. Marine Le Pen may have been defeated, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that is a permanent condition. You have Brexit in the UK, and then you have the Trump administration in the USA. And what we can say is that each one of these is a revolutionary movement against the status quo, but not necessarily broadly cohesive across the group, that they all tend to have a different populist vent depending on exactly what the outlook is for that particular country. And what we're getting in the US right now, and the clear reason for its outperformance on the Nasdaq, is because of fiscal stimulus. And the US is stimulating in a well-developed expansion already, where you already have this period of time where we have almost full employment. And that's also against a background where there are large numbers of people leaving the workforce because of aging. So, what that is essentially doing is stimulating in the throes of an already well-developed expansion, and it has the potential to contribute to an acceleration in markets. And we did have some acceleration towards the beginning of January, where there was, I think, that could have been described as the buy the rumor, sell the news advance. And now we're seeing that the markets appear to be on the cusp of breaking out. Well, the Nasdaq and the Russell 2000 have been the clear leaders. And then I think we need to keep an eye on the S&P 500. Well, that yet has not broken out, and it is still a fair amount below its peak. So if we're looking for a medium-term correction lasting 6 months, well, that is certainly potentially possible on the S&P 500, and it may last longer than that before it can break upwards to new all-time highs. But it has held the region of the trend mean on three separate occasions, and it is firming once more. So this is reasonably positive trading. And considering the fact that there have been a substantial number of people talking about the cyclically adjusted PE, and that it is at it is not at all-time highs, but it is the second highest level that it has been in history. Well, the reality is that that gives us a condition, or it gives us an idea of where we are in the cycle. It does not tell us when the end of the cycle is going to be. And what I think has to be considered is that by the time this secular bull market eventually ends, then there is the potential that that cyclically adjusted PE could be at a new all-time high. And if one were to consider that possibility, then these markets are cheap. So that is perhaps the one of the most contrarian ideas that I could come up with, that we are in a secular bull market, and that this environment is going to persist, that we are going to have more of the kind of fiscal stimulus that has been pioneered by the USA, that if you want to solve a populist uprising, you give the people what they want, and what the people want is more money. So you can also try to give them more jobs, but that takes rather more time, and politicians don't have a great record of creating jobs. What they are very good at is spending money. So if that is indeed the case, then it is also worth taking a look at what is going on in the bond markets. Because US 10-year treasuries had a very meaningful week last week. The yield got all the way down, excuse me, all the way down to test the region of the lower side, or at least the region of the trend mean and the most recent higher reaction low, and then we had a fairly significant bounce. And I think it's worth just zooming in and looking at that on a weekly basis. So when we think about what is going on there was a very large short position in US Treasuries, and that was a significant short covering rally. Now let's look at the futures, because obviously that is where the short position was most acute. And when we look at the 10-year Treasury future, it experienced a meaningful rally intra-week, but was not able to be held. Was not able to be held throughout the end of the week. Now, that's not bullish. And what that suggests is that we know why there was such a lot of pressure on the futures prices over the course of the mid from now. Back through to the middle of 2017, and it's because there's such an enormous amount of additional supply hitting this market. So then we have to at least consider that with so much additional supply that there may be a dearth of buyers, that the market may experience some indigestion at those at that wall of new supply hitting the market. And we also, I mean, what I find very interesting is that so far we have not had wage growth. When we look at exactly what's going on in terms of annual year-over-year earnings, then wages have not yet really broken out, but they are holding around the 2.6% level. And we know, for example, that the cost of living is rising somewhat, but that the that because of this populist advance, the fiscal stimulus is likely to contain earning the people demanding higher wages simply because they're getting more money in their paycheck as a result of the tax cuts. And that is going to persist for a while longer. But minimum wages are going to be rising over the course of the next couple of years, and they'll be $15 in California and in places like New York in the not too distant future. And $15 for a minimum wage is a substantial level, but there aren't that many people earn the minimum wage, but there are plenty of people who earn the equivalent of the minimum wage, which would be almost like prime plus one. So those people are going to want a pay rise as well, and that is when you start to get this upward pressure on wages. Well, there's no other country in the world would benefit more from rising wages than Japan. And interestingly, nobody mentioned Japan. There was a wide-ranging conversation, and everyone was limited to 2 minutes. So nobody mentioned Japan at around the table, which, from my perspective at least, is probably the most contrarian conclusion of all. That it hasn't done enough recently to merit a lot of news headlines because the market has been rather disappointing over the course of the last couple of months, and it hasn't been on the headlines because there's any new spectacular reform. But if the labor market in much of the developed world is tight, it's even tighter in Japan. So when I was there a few months ago, what we're seeing, particularly outside of Tokyo, is that there's rather large numbers of foreign workers, and I'm not at all sure that those are counted in the official numbers. But we met people from South Korea, and actually, if I'm more accurate, we met women from South Korea, China, and Thailand, the Philippines, in different establishments that we visited in our tour of Osaka, Kobe, and Kyoto. So what that at least says to me is that yes, there is labor tightness in Japan, and that we're getting the normal response to labor tightness, that workers are finding jobs, and that the government is likely looking the other way to illegal immigration because it is helping to solve the problem without having to make any kind of big policy statements about it. And that's exactly what you get everywhere else. But what immigration tends to do to an economy is create growth. And that's also a rather disruptive idea as well. But when we look at what's going on with the Nikkei, it has sustained a move above 20,000. And in the course of that bear market from 1989, from at least 1992 onwards, it has been unable to sustain a move above 20,000. So this is clearly different. We are now, in all likelihood, in a first step above the base. And it suggests that there is a new evolving bull market in Japan. So then the question is, when do wages start to feed through into the official statistics? I think the place where it will be most observable will be in the bank shares. and banks were at the lower side of their range over the last week and are showing just very early signs of starting to steady. But then the I think that the likelihood is that with Wall Street is beginning to firm again in here this week, that Japan will start to firm next week. So I think that's also a rather interesting set of circumstances. Now, there were also people that were taking a somewhat more cautious perspective, and there were some people that were taking a more bullish perspective. There are plenty of people who think that it was rather interesting. There was one half of the table was rather bullish on China, and then the other half of the table wasn't. So what we can certainly say there is that China's ranging. That you can make a market in the outlook for the Chinese stock market. But what we can certainly say about the A-share market is that it has been struggling to hold a low over the course of the last few months. Now, part of the reason for that is because there is this cracking down on the shadow banking sector, and they are gradually allowing defaults. And considering that just about all debt was considered risk-free until about 18 months ago, that is a major change. And the Shanghai property sector is also not performing. So what we also know is that China is going to be introducing a property tax, and that's going to increase the holding cost for the kinds of people that own hundreds of apartments. And then they are going to be under greater pressure to rent them out. And if they do rent them out, well, then that's going to increase the supply. And if you increase the supply, the price goes down. But property prices in China are astronomically high, and a lot of household wealth is tied up in them. So that's a potential headwind that is sitting out there on the horizon. Property taxes in China are a potential catalyst for a meaningful correction in the Chinese market. But there is the additional point in China that they're setting up CDRs, which are Chinese depository receipts, and they are trying to lure home some of the big companies like Alibaba. Well, it is interesting that Alibaba was testing its highs this week because it's about to list a CDR in China. And what that would allow is for the first time mainland Chinese investors to buy the share. So, on the one hand, that could be acting as a headwind for the domestic market currently as people raise cash ahead of getting a much bigger opportunity to invest in technology shares. And if we take it from that perspective, then there was another company that was suggested at the contrary opinion for our dinner, which is YY. And YY is I'd say skirting on what shall we say the vice side of social media, but it has bounced rather impressively from the region of its trend mean. Wuba is also looking rather like a consolidation rather than a top. And then if we look at, for example, I'm not sure this is the right ticker, the education sector, then that has been one of the clearest outperformers among the companies that are listed overseas. And Chinese investors haven't been able to buy these household name companies. So these continue to represent the growth in the Chinese stock market, and they may get an additional leg on the upside when mainland investors get to buy them. So that also has the potential to be a catalytic event in the Chinese market. But my fear for China is outside of these what I would consider trading opportunities. The broad perspective is that it is an emerging fascist state. And I am not making any direct comparisons, but rather to look at what the definition of that means, that it is national socialism. And national socialism is simply that the sovereign allows private enterprise to exist only to such an extent that it is an arm of government policy. And that is exactly what is happening in China. In China, when you think about governance, you do not have a respect for minority shareholder interests, you do not have an independent judiciary, and you do not have an independent press. But on top of that, now over the course of the last couple of years, you have had outright war waged on freedom of association, and then also you no longer have a collegial oligarchy, but rather you have a dictatorship. So if we also look at what China is doing internationally, they are building a blue water navy. They are building, they have one base now already. They launched their first domestically produced aircraft carrier 2 weeks ago. There are news stories that there are military grade lasers being shined at the U.S. Navy pilots in Djibouti. There are embassy workers from Canada and the U.S. have been complaining of sound wave attacks in embassies in Cuba and indeed in Guangzhou. So now the question is whether the South China Sea is China's Sudetenland. Now that's those are big questions, and what it also suggests is that these are not questions that are going to be answered overnight. Then we have North Korea, and North Korea is a vassal state of China, and the reality is that China has a series of buffer states around its border, which act as part of its geopolitical strategy. So the prospect of reunification will have to come at some form of cost for China. And China does not have a domestic semiconductor manufacturing sector. Most of the raw materials are produced in Taiwan and South Korea and then are exported into China for manufacturing. So Taiwan Semiconductor has got massive manufacturing systems within China, but those are assembly plants rather than raw material plants. And China wants to have its own domestic semiconductor business because it's worried about firmware attacks that could potentially come from the US. Over the last couple of years, and part of the Edward Snowden revelations are that there was code written into the firmware of just about every a computer processor in the world by the NSA so that it would allow backdoor access. And that's a very difficult thing to counteract. So China does want to have a domestic semiconductor manufacturing sector. That's obviously a threat, and they don't have it just yet. And they may not have it for another 10 years, but it is what they do want to have. As part of the end game. And if they get that, then that will also help to create a bipolar world. And in the bipolar world, oil is a very big consideration. Now, when we think about oil over the very long term, I think we can have at least 100 years of data. So, when we think about where are we in terms of the cycle, then oil prices tend to move in very long term. I don't exactly know why that's not working. Hold on. There we go. The log scale chart of oil tends to go sideways and then it goes up a lot. And then it goes sideways and it goes up a lot. And it goes sideways and then it goes up a lot. Well, it's been going sideways since about 2007. And we are still rallying up from the lower side of the range. And I think that the range is going to be between about $35 and $100. And it's going to be ranging like that for at least another 10 years. And part of the reason for that is because of technological innovation, but also because there has been a rising cost of production. Secular bull markets in commodities are defined by a rising cost of marginal production. And the new source of marginal production that has come into the market as a result of technological innovation in this cycle has been shale oil and gas out of North America. And that is a major game changer because what we've seen over the course of the last week has been that Russia and and OPEC have agreed to increase their supply, and that's holding out the prospect now of a reversionary move in the oil price. But at this and part of the reason that they've agreed to do that is because of surging supply coming through from the USA. The USA is now the largest producer of oil in the world, and that's a change, a meaningful change from where we were 10 years ago. Well, that also creates the potential that the US is going to be less inclined to be the global policeman because it doesn't need to if it has a if it's largely energy self-sufficient. But if that's the case, then that opens up the possibility that someone else will want to become the global policeman. Well, China is now the biggest consumer of oil, and it is looking rather unlikely that it is going to be the biggest producer. That's despite the fact that China has some of the biggest reserves of shale oil in the world. The rather urgent problem for them is that it's mostly located in Sichuan and Yunnan, and that those are seismically active already and very mountainous regions. It is not on the plains of North Dakota or in Texas, which are considerably easier to drill in. So then it is likely that China is going to become one of the main global police forces over the course of not the next year, over the course of the next 20 years. So we have these two rather important themes. You have the rise of populism, and that's primarily an effect that's occurring as a result of globalization and the negative effects of globalization. You also then have China, which has benefited probably more than any other country from globalization. The reason that globalization was sold so effectively to the people of the OECD was because it was considered that if China was able to get up to a GNP of approximately $5,000, that liberalism and democracy would naturally flourish. And it has subsequently been proved, and we have now got ample evidence for that, that that was a flawed hypothesis. That you do get markets evolving and you do get standards of living rising as GNP rises, but it is that does not create a flowering of democracy. And that's problematic now, because what has been created is a geopolitical competition between two major powers. And what that does suggest is that there will be trade wars, and that there will be more tariffs, and that a blind observance to to thinking that we're going to have a global, a permanent global logistics chain, is, I think, going to be increasingly challenged. There is going to be more cherry picking. And what that means is that some markets will definitely do better than others, that there will be some that are very much within the Chinese sphere of influence, and there will be those that aren't. And for example, North Korea is within the Chinese sphere of influence, and South Korea is in the USA's sphere of influence. So what is going on in North in terms of the negotiations between the two is I think a geopolitical dance that it really is worth keeping a very close eye on. And I don't think I'm politically astute enough to really make a prediction as to exactly what's going to come out of it, but I do think that and it was something that someone else mentioned at the dinner the other night, was that we'll have peace there, that a peace treaty will be signed. Exactly what that's going to mean in terms of development for North Korea will remain to be seen, but they would rather be starting from day zero in terms of infrastructure development. So there is the potential for growth there. Then India would be the West's hope, great hope for a counterbalance to China in Asia. And in India, you do have respect for minority shareholder interests, an independent judiciary, and a free press. And you have a democratic process. Now, you do have the rise of nationalism here too, but it's not nearly as vociferous as it is elsewhere. And the Indian market bounced rather well in here last week, but more importantly, the rupee has stabilized in the region of its lows. And that is, I think, much more meaningful, that it does now look like the Indian market is going to be unwinding its oversold condition. Everyone, of course, is watching what's going to happen with the US dollar. And the US dollar got up to 95 in here this week and then paused. Now, if we look at the trend, and if we were to take the label off the chart, well, we can see that there was a reasonably well-defined base between about 2008 and 2014, and then it has bounced rather emphatically. Then we got this very volatile range, mostly above 90, and the previous range was below 90. So we have a short-term overbought condition on the dollar, but really a sustained move below 90 would be required to question that we're not in a bull market environment overall. And it has rallied very impressively for the last 8 weeks, so there is the potential now for some pause and consolidation. So then if we look at what's going on with gold, well, gold prices have been going sideways for much of the last few months, most particularly as the dollar has been rallying. And it finished out the week below $1,300. So it's now right in the region of the lows that have been put in over the course of the last few weeks. Well, if gold is going to continue to represent a bullish environment, then it should be able to hold this $1,300 area. There has been a progression of higher reaction lows over the course of the last 18 months, and the most recent of those is around $1,240. So, if it is still in a bullish environment over the medium term, then that low around $1,240 will be the most important touchstone within the evolution of this environment. There is a headwind that the USA is raising interest rates. But I think also important is that the US dollar has been rather firm and the euro has been rather weak. So gold got up towards the 1130 euro area earlier last week, and then has been in a process of consolidation over the last couple of days. But if we think about what the outlook is, then if we look at it on a weekly basis, that there is an evolving, I think it does to me look like the most likely trajectory for prices is upwards against, for gold against the euro. And then the pound has also been subject to a fair share of volatility and is coming back up towards £1,000 per ounce. Then, if you look at some of the currencies where we have had significant deterioration, well, then gold is coming up towards 5,000 rial. And in India, it is close, but coming back from that 90,000 rupee to the ounce level. So gold has been comparatively firm in a significant number of currencies. But the dollar has been resurgent, so gold prices have been having a more difficult time in both dollars and yen. So gold is a monetary metal, and if it tends to do best when it is appreciating against all currencies, and it's appreciating against most currencies, but it was probably not first, but third in terms of the rankings. And it does remain for the bulls to prove that this rounding, saucering characteristic we've had over the last 5 years is going to be resolved on the upside. If we look at some of the clearly contrarian moves, then Sibanye Gold has been spending a great deal of money on buying Stillwater Mining and expanding and really building out its position in platinum. Platinum is probably the most contrarian of the precious metals because of the diesel scandal and people just not wanting diesel catalytic converters. The price is steadying at the lower side of its range. Then the other rather contrarian idea was uranium, and uranium prices are, I think, rather interesting at these levels because it has come down and it is certainly steadying around $20. Two of the most important things that have happened over the last few months have been that Cameco has closed down its largest mine. It's even buying it's buying its uranium on the spot market for delivery now. So it is withdrawing supply from the market. And Paladin Energy announced the same thing last week. The Kazakh government is also withdrawing supply from the market. They're looking at IPOing part of their company. And what that suggests is that, well, the longer that that kind of activity persists, the greater the potential is that we're going to see the supply come out of the market and create a shortage. And Cameco is now trading back above its trend mean. Now, it has been pulling back over the last few weeks, but if we think about what the potential is in terms of what effect the somewhat higher oil price is going to have on considerations by governments, then the potential for uranium to start to come back into a more fashionable perspective, when let's be honest, it couldn't be more unfashionable right now, then there's the potential for at least a partial recovery in the uranium sector. Then I think it's also interesting what a lot of people have been talking about Tesla, that the share is currently around $291, and it has been pausing below the $300 level, and they've been booking the deposits they've been taking for the Model 3 as income. Well, that's not income. Those are deposits, but quite whether that, which is effectively a very murky way of reporting earnings, is going to continue to be tolerated by regulators, I think is probably one of the biggest challenges facing the company. But there is also an important point about the share, and it's about how difficult it is to short. There is If we look at the short interest as a percentage of the float, it's rather high. In fact, it's very difficult to borrow shares to short Tesla. There's a rather large short position already in place, but the price has not gone down. And I know that I have been rather negative on the share, and but against that background and the fact that the price has been holding, I think we have to be potentially prepared to be surprised on the upside. And I think that's also a rather contrarian idea at this stage of the market environment. Then it was something that I forgot to talk about, but it was I kind of ran out of time to get out my contrarian ideas. I'm rather interested in Atlas Mara from a contrarian perspective, because the share has done nothing but decline since its IPO in 2014, but it has been going sideways now for a year and a half, and this is an attempt to form a Pan-African bank, and the share is rather moribund at the moment. It's not really going anywhere, but it is not going down any longer. And I think that when one looks at Africa, then there is the potential for longer-term gains, considering that it is where the vast majority of additional new people are going to be coming from in the next 20 to 30 years. People talk about the really attractive demographics of Turkey, but Turkey's demographics are considered against a background of the region in which it sits. Africa has got some of the most compelling demographics of anywhere on Earth. So the Turkish lira has paused below the 5 lira to the dollar level. Now, this has I think the market is starting to weigh what has been going on, and they've raised interest rates by 3%, so that certainly helped to chasten some of the most very aggressive bears. But then you have the big question is, was it enough? And what that chart suggests to me is that maybe not yet. They may have to raise interest rates again to really chasten the bears and make shorting even more expensive. But the chances are that that is what they will do. Now, if we look at some of the ETFs that we have for the Turkish market, then they had come all the way right back down to the lower side of their respective ranges, and they have not yet bounced emphatically. There was the potential that this low around 1500p would hold, and it did close back below it on Friday. So we do need to have more conclusive evidence that the outlook is changing for the currency before people will start to come back in. And that's probably an extreme example, but I think it does help to highlight what's going on in the emerging markets generally, that the dollar has been resurgent and it has started to put pressure on the currencies of dollar borrowers. And that has most particularly been a threat in places like Brazil and Argentina and Turkey, but not so much of a threat in Asia or the ASEAN region. I posted a report on Friday or Thursday highlighting that point, that yes, there is substantial dollar borrowing, but it is the original sin of the Asian financial crisis has not is not as powerful as it is today. So I think those are some of the more important points. I think the most important point is that I was at the last time I was at a contrarian club dinner was about 4 years ago, where my idea was that biotech was a big deal, and I got a lot of resistance from that, from some of the other people at the table. And this time around, there was a lot more people who were interested in technology. Now, we know that technological innovation is a very key point, but it's not as contrarian today as it was 5 or 6 years ago. And I think it is becoming more mainstream, and that can't help but be the case considering just how much technology has outperformed the wider market. And I think that that is that when I go to a dinner or a meeting like this in future and everyone is touting technology, well, that will probably be the greatest a contrarian idea that one might have. So I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.